A new report from Feeding America using 2023 data found that before President Trump took office, people in every U.S. county faced hunger. And in some areas, childhood food insecurity was as high as 50%. Today, the fight against food insecurity is getting more challenging. Millions of meals aren't making it to tables across the U.S. That's due to cuts made in March by the Trump administration at the Department of Agriculture, specifically to programs funding farms, schools, and food banks. Now, food banks all over the country are struggling to keep up with the rise in demand.
Two shipments of eggs, each 750 cases, canceled. Cheese, 825 cases, canceled. Chicken, 800 cases canceled.
It comes at a time of increasing need at food pantries in our network. We've seen over 30% increase in visits over the past year.
Times are asking me, hey, is there any more chicken? Is there any more of this? Is there any more meats? Any more eggs coming anytime soon? Do you know when? And unfortunately, I can't provide them. You know, I can't give them a date when they're going to come back.
The pinch felt at food banks comes as House Republicans push through their sweeping reconciliation bill with deep cuts to SNAP benefits. As concerns over ongoing inflation and food insecurity spikes in some counties, how are food banks and farms responding to a loss in federal funding? And how will these cuts affect communities across the country? I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast. We'll be back with our guests in just a moment. Let's get to it. Marsha Brown joins us in studio. She's a food and agriculture reporter at Politico, covering federal agencies and the business of food. Marsha, it's great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And joining us from Texas is Brian Green. He's the president and CEO of the Houston Food Bank. That's the largest food bank in the U.S., feeding about a million people annually across 18 counties in southeast Texas. It's also part of the Feeding America Network. Brian, welcome to the program.
Jen, thank you so much for having us on.
So in March, Marsha, the USDA cut over $1 billion in federal funding to food banks. The cuts also axed a program that provided schools with fresh foods from local farms. What programs specifically were cut?
Right. So there are two programs called Local Food for Schools and Local Food Purchase Cooperative Agreement Program, which is the program that provided funding to food banks. And in total, that was about a little over $1 billion. And what those programs did is they gave money to schools and food banks to buy from local farmers. So it was a way for new contracts for small and mid-sized farms to get these new contracts and provide blueberries or wheat or, you know, all kinds of fresh food, chicken, eggs to, places in their region rather than kind of like big international food conglomerates.
Well, we heard from Nicholas in Ohio who says food banks are very important. The fact that they are getting cut is a travesty. We can and need to do better as a country to treat those who are struggling. Well, we did reach out to the USDA about these cuts, and a spokesperson sent this statement saying, quote, from the start of the fiscal year through February 2025, the department has spent nearly $780 million on TFAP, or the Emergency Food Assistance Program, foods and administrative expenses, which is not unusual in a five-month period. Not to mention, as of Wednesday, states have nearly $250 million in local purchasing authority that is specific to the charitable feeding network. Finally, on any given day, the department has used more than $405 million worth of nutrition benefits across its 16 nutrition programs. There's no need to continue pandemic aid or create new programs, but perhaps more efficient use of current programs and funding. And you'll find that statement at the1a.org. Marsha, just decode that for us. Were these pandemic programs that were cut?
Yeah, that's a great question. So these programs did come out of the pandemic in the sense that the pandemic revealed all these, tangled supply chains. There were shortages. Farmers were dumping their milk. And the Biden administration realized, like, how can we strengthen these supply chains and diversify supply chains and suppliers? And so they developed these programs. And in some ways, they came out of the Trump administration's food boxes to families program. They were kind of fine-tuning that. And so these programs were really about food chain resiliency, and they were also, about the weaknesses revealed by the pandemic. And so they stood up these programs. They were extremely popular. Almost every state had contracts, and schools loved them because they helped them meet these Buy American requirements for school meals and helped them provide healthier, fresher food.
Did the administration provide any other reasons for these cuts?
So the money for the local foods programs comes from a New Deal era account called the Commodity Credit Corporation. And what that does is it gives the Agriculture Secretary broad authority to provide funding for different priority areas. And we do see with different administrations, they prioritize different things. This is the same fund that the Trump administration used to provide almost $20 billion in bailout money to farmers. And I should say that some of those billions did go to food banks. They used that money to buy commodities like pork, and those went to food banks during the pandemic and during a time when food banks were experiencing increasing need. I should also add that, you know, there was another half a million canceled to the Emergency Food Assistance Program that was also from the CCC fund. And that money was planned to help food banks address both the rising cost of food, because they're buying food, right? It's more expensive to buy food, and rising need, because consumer grocery bills are just not going as far. And so these additional funds that the Trump administration is pointing to now do help. But from what I'm hearing from food bank leaders, it's just not quite the same. And there's still this increased need. And with the reconciliation bill, we'll see increased pressure on food banks.
Well, Brian, this is a great time to turn to you. I'd love to hear how these cuts are affecting your food bank.
Yeah. Well, Houston is just one of 250 Feeding America food banks around the country. We're all pretty much seeing the same thing. In our case, the cuts work out to about 40 tractor trailer loads per month of USDA commodities that we won't be receiving. And as we work with our 1,600 partners serving about a million people a year, that's a really big hit. And it's causing a lot of pain for the people that we serve. And at the food bank level, you know, we're having to make adjustments. Now, this is in addition to the loss of funding that we were able to purchase from local farmers and other local agribusiness, which was a really neat initiative, a great partnership. So we have that reduction, and then we have funding reduction of over $3 million just to help pay operating costs. So in so many ways, you know, we're struggling. And at the same time, there are more people who are food insecure. This is just the cruel irony of this is it's not pandemic-driven. It's with rising not just food costs, but rent costs, et cetera, is eaten into the wage gains that households had. So there are simply more families who are struggling. And because food tends to be the flexible expense, that's where they take the hit, because they have to pay all their rent. They have to pay all their utility bills. So where do they make the cuts? It's in food. That's where we try to step in. But the resources to do that are being cut significantly.
Well, we're also hearing from other food bank workers about how these cuts are affecting them. Here's Markel Miller with Food Gatherers at the Food Bank in Michigan.
The cut to USDA food represents an abrupt loss of 15% of our food distribution, or the equivalent of 1.2 million meals. This USDA food was a reliable source of American agricultural products, many of which come from Michigan producers. The food we get from the USDA is distributed throughout our community at shelters, food pantries, meal programs, and grocery distributions at affordable housing sites and schools. We know that many of our neighbors facing food insecurity also have diet-related illnesses. The USDA was a source of really healthy food, and now we must raise a lot more money to try to replace what we lost without any heads up.
Brian, we hear there from Markel that they didn't have a heads up about these cuts. How did the federal government let you know about the changes?
Well, these happen in very rapid manner. And to me, it was like kind of we've had hurricanes down here and there's incomplete information and it's changing every day. And that's kind of what this was like. I think they did their best, but they were having to make cuts rapidly and make adjustments to those. And so, the communication was not ideal.
So big picture, Brian, how are you adjusting to the cuts and what does it mean for the people who you're trying to support?
Well, you know, the way food banks are is we mostly get surplus food from the food industry. You know, we are kind of the scramblers that try and make good what can't be sold. And the USDA commodities are really a component of that, because so much of that is the government stepping in to help support farms with their surplus. And it comes to us in great condition, and we just absolutely love the USDA commodities. With those cuts, we're having to make, of course, significant decreases in how much we distribute. We are laying off over 40 people. And we're having to communicate to all of our partners that we're trying to make these cuts as evenly as we can, which is difficult to do because We can't just have the trucks run 80% full. So instead, it's getting a little bit clunky. So there are a lot of canceled distributions that we're having to do. And this is letting down a lot of families who depend on us. And we're hoping that we can somewhat stabilize our routes and our procedures and then push more and more towards fresh produce. But there's no way that we can make up this difference.
Let's pause here. What other changes are happening at the USDA? That's next. Let's get back to our discussion with this message we got from one of you. Lisa writes, I'm a libertarian, so I believe in personal freedom and personal responsibility. I don't think it's healthy for our society to have people dependent on the government, and I don't like tax money being spent this way when we have a huge national debt. Families, churches, and local charities should help the truly needy. Brian, I'd love to get your response to that as someone who's working on the ground with people who are food insecure.
You know, that is a very good point that our friend makes. But I want to also point out that, you know, the scale for us to do that is not what people think. So if you look at SNAP compared to the output of all the food banks put together, SNAP is actually 9 times as large. So just an 11% cut in SNAP is financially the equivalent of wiping out every food bank in America. And it's my understanding that that's what's coming out of the House is cuts that are that actually larger than that. The reality is the charitable sector in America is amazing, but no, there is no way that we can make up that kind of difference. And the partnership that USDA and the food banks have had for years, which we love, has been great for American farmers, which helps stabilize agribusiness in the United States. This is one of the reasons why we're so good at that, where food is comparatively so low cost in the U.S. compared to most of the world relative to income. Because of that partnership, we're able to help people. But mostly what we're trying to do is hope that people have the resources on their own, just as I think the caller does. And that's where I think SNAP really helps make that happen.
Well, and Lisa also refers to helping the truly needy. Who typically accesses your food bank in Houston?
Yeah, that's another thing that a lot of people don't know, and it's a reasonable question, is, well, who is this? Are these people who are unemployed and, you know, could be working? Overwhelmingly, who we're serving is actually households that are working and have children. So the Census Bureau, in their annual ACS study, they find that about 2/3 of the food insecure households have an adult who works. Low-wage employment has become the number one enemy for food security in America. And that's who we're going to, is people who, you know, the households are struggling, they're working, but they're not making enough money to consistently make ends meet. And so food tending to be the flexible expense is where they take the hit. And so that's who's coming to the churches and the other organizations that we supply to try and get some help.
Well, this morning, House Republicans advanced a far-reaching bill to support the Trump administration's agenda. And in that bill, there are some deep cuts to the SNAP benefits program. It heads to the Senate next. Here's Terry Shoemaker, the executive vice president of the Arizona Food Bank Network, who called us last night before passage of the bill this morning, talking about what these cuts in particular could mean for their network.
The current House budget proposal, if passed, would be devastating for Arizona food banks and the more than 700,000 people who are relying on them for help each month. And that's for a couple of different reasons. The way SNAP cuts are being proposed, especially because of the expanded work requirements, would mean that, you know, for example, a 63-year-old grandfather who helped take care of his grandson so that his daughter can work full time would have to find and maintain a 20-hour-a-week job in order to keep his SNAP benefits, even though he's already providing free labor. And it also means fewer groceries and more stress for families that are already living on the edge. And that means more people will need help from food banks.
Marcia, give us more detail about how SNAP benefits are affected in this bill.
So there's a few major changes that this bill presents, and it still has to go through the Senate, and so I expect that there will be significant change. But the biggest cost savings that Republicans found is by moving the cost of the benefits and the cost of the administrative costs onto states. And the concern with that is that a lot of states you know, have to balance their budgets. And a sudden cost increase means that they might look for ways to cut benefits or make it more difficult for people to access benefits. And so that, we don't know exactly what that would look like, but that most people expect that that will mean that a lot of people no longer have access to SNAP benefits. And then we've already talked about this a little bit, but they are raising the work requirement. So now it's going up from 54 to 64. So if you're people up to age of 64 have to meet these work requirements, and more parents will have to meet these work requirements. So if you're caring for a child, you will have to meet the work requirements in order to stay on the program. And then there's also some cuts to SNAP Ed, which is a smaller program but helps with nutrition education, helps people learn how to choose healthy foods, be active. It's an anti-obesity program. And it also restricts eligibility for some lawfully present immigrants. And, you know, one thing that I talked to some you know, organizations about is that those changes will mean that immigrant parents who have U.S. citizen children may no longer be able to access SNAP benefits. So we're talking, for example, about asylees. And then I think, you know, another aspect of this is they're going to restrict the increases of the Thrifty Food Plan, which is the basis of how we calculate the SNAP benefit. So over time, anti-hunger advocates say that that will mean the benefit gets smaller relative to the cost of food. And then finally, SNAP is very closely tied to school meals. So as fewer people are eligible for SNAP, that means that fewer people will be eligible for, or fewer people will be eligible automatically for school meals. So they'll have to apply for school meals, which is stigmatized and often just more difficult. And families are not used to that because that was kind of withdrawn during the pandemic. And there are some schools and districts that are automatically eligible district-wide because they're high poverty districts. And that could also be eroded if fewer families are qualifying for SNAP.
Brian, when we talk about the over $1 billion in cuts that have already been made, and then the proposals in this House bill, who are you most concerned about in your community? Who do you think would be most affected by the multiple cuts people could be facing or the increased requirements?
Yeah, the biggest hit families are going to be younger families with children. Because, you know, that's when people tend to be earlier in their income stream. So they're working, but they're not making that much money. And they've got the extra expenses of young children. So they're already struggling. This is going to probably increase homelessness. This is going to increase all kinds of family trauma. This is going to decrease nutrition for these children, which will have long-term implications. There's just so many ramifications that we're going to see coming out of this.
Well, you mentioned, Marcia, that we'll likely see changes to the bill in the Senate. What are you watching for?
So already we've seen some Republicans expressing skepticism about the cost share proposal with states, which would require states to front the money for this program. Some states are already kind of, you know, making noise that this is going to be very expensive and that they won't be able to, you know, meet the requirements here to continue providing the program at the same level.
So, Brian, how are you communicating with those in your community who rely on the food bank about the changes that are already happening and the changes that might be coming?
So we do our work with, you know, through the partner organizations who are actually on the front lines serving the public. And so we've tried to be in very tight communication as we go along. And then it is through our media friends that we're generally trying to talk to the general public. But mostly we're also trying to keep people calm because if you're really struggling to get by, I mean, this can be really, really scary information. So we're trying also not to, create panic. This is a very significant cut. I mean, we're looking at about 15% of our distribution whacked off. And that's not, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at, but it's not like we will not be able to provide any help. So we're also trying to provide reassurance and with the hope that we'll be able to get this turned around.
Marcia, earlier this month, you reported that nearly 15,000 USDA employees took the Trump administration's offer to resign. What are some of the areas in the agency that took the biggest hits?
So, 15,000 workers decided to leave the USDA. And that represents about 15% of the agency. There's about 100,000 people at USDA. Most of these workers are not in D.C. They're around the country in local and regional offices. We saw 30% of people in the Food and Nutrition Service, a part of USDA, which administers school meals and administers the food bank programs that we've been talking about. So a lot of those folks decided to leave. We also saw significant departures at the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, which handles animal diseases and testing and is handling the federal response to the bird flu. It also does things like inspect animals and livestock and different food items coming in at the border. And then we also saw significant departures at the Forest Service, which both handles, management of wild lands, but also responds to wildfires.
Brian, you've been in this line of work for about 36 years now. What would you say to people who have reservations about providing this type of support and who say, listen, if you can work, you should be able to feed yourself? Or if you're quote unquote able-bodied, why are you accessing food from a food bank? What would you say to people who don't understand the connection between work and food insecurity?
Yeah, I would say, go to a fast food restaurant and see who's working there now compared to when I started in food banking. It is overwhelmingly adults. This is how they're making a living to try and support their family on the kind of wages that we used to think of as teenage employment. This is a big obstacle for America, and these families are doing the best they can. And for us to provide them help is only the decent thing to do.
That's Brian Green. He's the president and CEO of the Houston Food Bank. That's the largest food bank in the U.S., feeding about 1 million people annually across 18 counties in southeast Texas. It's also part of the Feeding America Network. Brian, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Jen.
Let's go to a quick break here. Up next, we talk to a Minnesota farmer about how he will be affected by these federal cuts. Stay with us. Let's get back to it with a new guest. Funway Tita joins us from Otsego, Minnesota. He's the owner of Better Greens LLC. That's a farm that provides culturally significant vegetables to African communities. Funway, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So Otsego is a northwest suburb of the Twin Cities. Tell us more about the mission of your farm. You launched it in 2016. What does Better Greens set out to do?
Well, our mission is kind of twofold. We are out to preserve African culture, cultural heritage through food, and also to make healthy, nutrient-rich, and culturally appropriate vegetables accessible to the mainstream food systems. And we do that through partnerships with the co-ops, the schools, the food shelves, and some community partners. And then the other part is also, we are really trying to make sure that access to these vegetables is absolutely available, because that has been a challenge, at least in my experience and many others in my community.
Where does your economic program fit into your broader mission?
Well, the economic program is that we need to be sustainable, in order to be able to achieve these goals. We realize that. And so that's why these cuts are so hurting for us as a business and for our community as well, that we're joining forces to be able to do this. And so we're looking at least this year, maybe on the very low side, about 60% of our revenue is going to probably be lost as due to this cut, right? And so we're just hanging there by the thread right now and scrambling to see where we can find new avenues for markets. And so that's just my story, but then it's the story that is across, the community of African immigrant farmers that I'm also, and our business is deeply entrenched. So it is a really tough time for us, and we're dealing with that right now.
We got this email from Nancy, who says, people forget that the original purpose of all food aid programs was to subsidize and support agriculture, mainly small independent farms. Now, Funway, your farm benefited from the LFPA, or the Local Food Purchase Assistance Cooperative Agreement program, which the Trump administration recently cut. What did that program allow you to do?
Well, like I said, that's why most of our business is coming from, as a small farmer, and more so a farmer that is in a line of a product that is not really kind of out there or mainstream. We were depending on these programs in order to be able to get a foothold into that whole sector. We cannot have access right now to the major grocery stores in terms of having our products on those produce aisles. So we depend on programs that are funded through the LFP to be able to gain access to the market. You know, so this year when it was announced that those cuts happened, you know, it happened so late that we were only already in talks with our customers, you know, discussing how we are going to be able to supply for next year. We were already finalizing and signing contracts. And then we got to have to go back to the table and deal with this bad news that we might not be able to have access to those contracts this year. So it's been a really, really tough time, not only for me again, but for different farmers here, because that's 90% of them sell through those programs. 90% of them use that channel as a way of being able to, again, sustain culture through food and also add to the value of healthy food out there in the communities, and more so especially through the schools that have most of our children. And so bringing that diversity to those menus at school was very important, and we thought that was a good channel. We were feeling really good about this, and we saw a bright future for that. But all of a sudden, this is happening right now, and so we're just reeling with it.
Marcia, what are the potential ripple effects against the agricultural across the agricultural food chain that could come out of these cuts?
So the farmers that I've spoken to, they've made business decisions based on an understanding that this program was going to go ahead, that schools would keep buying their blueberries and their, you know, other crops, and that food banks would keep buying from them, and that there would be enough money for them to make these business decisions. You know, I've heard from a lot of folks, they bought a larger truck or they made some kind of capital investment in their farm, and now they're on the hook for that money, but they're not going to have these contracts going forward, and they have to find new buyers. And, you know, for example, I spoke to a farmer in West Virginia, and I think this is a great example where, you know, West Virginia, it's very rural, and this farmer grows blueberries, and the schools buy those blueberries, and it's really hard for that farmer to find an alternative buyer for that amount of blueberries. It's not easy for him to drive to a farmer's market because he's really far from a farmer's market, and there aren't necessarily that many people that would buy that amount of blueberries. So there's really this sort of scale question, and I think the ripple effects are widespread, and I think that's why people have been so, you know, loud about these cancellations. This was, you know, the agriculture secretary was actually asked about this by almost every Democrat in a recent testimony on the Hill. I was with her in Pennsylvania a few weeks ago, and local reporters were asking her about this. I've read local reports from across the country where she gets asked about this. This really just had far-reaching effects across the country, and a lot of farmers facing, you know, tariffs and also frozen grants, now seeing this cut as well, are really struggling.
Funway, I just want to better understand how much time you have to figure this out. The cuts came quickly. They weren't expected. When we talk about farming, we're not talking about something that you can pivot on overnight, right? This takes longer-term planning. How quickly do you have to figure out how to move forward and hold on to the work you're doing, maintain your farm?
That's the biggest challenge that we're facing right now, because, you know, the announcement came at a time where we had really no time. We wish as farmers that we could be able to hold time and find enough room to kind of figure out how, you know, what are the next steps we're going to take. But we don't have that time. The time keeps ticking on. Our business is in the line of, you know, weather. We're in the Midwest. You know, we have just so many months to be able to turn around. We don't have that time right now. So what we're doing right now is it's just moving forward by faith. You know, our plans for the season keep moving forward, and we're hoping. And that's why we're having this conversation. And that's why, you know, as part of the National Young Farmers Coalition, you know, I'm excited to see some of the groundswell towards a push to see if this could be changed. The efforts, the mobilization, which we are part of. That's the only hope that we have right now, is that something is going to change and help us. Other than that, it's going to come August, September, and we have produce lying in the garden and the farms getting rotten. Oh, we're just going to have to just give it out to the community, but that's an impact for the farming community. That means you're not going to be seeing new African immigrant farmers joining this ecosystem that is so important at this point because they're feeling discouraged. You're going to see that within the African Immigrant Farmers Association here in Minnesota, you know, there are already talks amongst within these farmers that, you know, they might just kind of fall off this whole endeavor. And so that is what we're reeling with right now. But for farmers like me that have kind of this is my focus right now. This is my business. This is what I focus on being able to provide for myself and also to support the community. So I'm scratching my head and asking key questions every night. What's going to happen tomorrow? Is something going to change? So we're at that point right now.
Yeah. We got this from Ian in New Orleans, who says, to try and fill the gap, could there be a push to give a property tax break to farmers equivalent to the amount of food that they donate to local food pantries? Marcia, is that a realistic option?
I think it's an interesting idea. I think off the bat, one of the challenges with that is a lot of farmers don't own their land, so they might not necessarily see the benefit of that property tax break. And then I think the other thing is that, you know, a lot of farmers are facing really tight margins, and farmers are price takers generally, and so it's really hard for them when input costs are going up to make a profit. And I think a property tax break might not really incentivize farmers to donate food if they can make more money by selling it on the market. And then the third aspect of this is that a lot of food that is donated to food banks doesn't necessarily come directly from farms. It might go through the retail network, and retailers then donate it to food banks. So it might be kind of hard to calculate how much farmers are effectively donating as well.
Marcia, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy says he plans to focus on combating childhood obesity and to try to get kids to eat healthier. A House Democrat sent a letter to Agriculture Secretary Brooke Wylans asking to clarify why the administration abruptly canceled the programs we're discussing and under what authority since Congress approved the program. But how has the Secretary administration responded to criticism about these cuts, especially as nutritional advocates say it goes against the Make America Healthy Again mission?
I think that's been one of the really interesting responses of this. I have seen online a lot that the MAHA kind of movement, that grassroots network of supporters of RFK's agenda, have really been upset about these cuts and, you know, been vocal about that. You know, Rollins defends them, the agriculture secretary. She defends these cuts, you know, says that pandemic-era programs are really not meant to go on forever and that they're, you know, not necessarily a good use of taxpayer dollars. And so I think, you know, this aspect of trying to, you know, address obesity and address, you know, healthy school meals is something that's been a priority, but we're not necessarily seeing that align with some of the policy choices. House Republicans have also just cut SNAP Ed, which I mentioned earlier, which is an anti-obesity nutrition educational program. And some folks that I talked to said that that's basically the opposite of MAHA. So it will be interesting to see kind of how this movement, you know, reckons with some of the policy changes coming from Congress and from the administration. You know, we're expecting later today a report from the Make America Healthy Again Commission, which we expect to touch on, you know, diet and chronic disease.
Funway, as a small farm, what concerns do you have right now about agricultural policies and funding changes under the Trump administration or about funding from the state of Minnesota?
Our concerns right now is the uncertainty. It's best when there's some conversations around this is some possibilities of something to work out. But right now, it's all doom and gloom in the farming community, especially for small farmers like myself, you know, where we solely, again, depend on these programs to be able to farm effectively. So we are following, we've been making presentations and testimonies at the state level here at the House, and just trying to push and see what is it that within the local government, within the state level, that they could do to mitigate some of the challenges that farmers are facing right now, given the fact that they've already committed to this season and they have been able to budget and everything is lined up on it. What can we do to salvage what is already going wrong? But again, I think what is more important for us and as a commitment is for us to continuously engage, you know, with our local officials, with our elected officials, in trying to see how we can be able to influence that policy in a way that we don't have to come back and maybe face this kind of situation again in the future.
Thank you to our guests today, Marsha Brown, a food and agriculture reporter at Politico, covering federal agencies and the business of food, and Funway Tita, the owner of Better Greens, LLC in Minnesota. It's a farm that provides culturally significant vegetables to African communities. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.